first time that I give the introduction. After 12 years of Richard coming to Munich, it's the 12th year now. And welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
We have a different, slightly different program this evening, and it's the first part of this kind of talk is about the book Confessions of a Seeker, that is Richard's latest book. You wrote that, or you have just about finished it, huh?
Yeah, less than a year ago, I think it came out, yes.
And also for me, this is the first time that I experience him as a seeker, because as long as I know you, you haven't been a seeker at all. So this is before the non-duality came in for you. And in that way, I also find it interesting that Richard has told his story very humorously and kind of sharp in a way, looking at the whole spiritual scene, actually worldwide, because he was traveling around to Nepal, India, and England, of course, tried all kinds of things from Buddhism, TM meditation, macrobiotic, hippies, drugs. What?
Like you.
Yeah, like me, yes, of course.
But his story as well.
So in that way, it's a very funny part, sometimes funny, sometimes critical. And I would like to also always see this on the background of non-duality, because it's clear that you don't promote spiritual growth with this book.
Mm-hmm. That is clear.
Yeah. So it is not that here anything of what is written here is meant to be taken seriously. Is it?
Seriously? Well, there's some quite critical things in there about certain philosophies and religions and so forth. Maybe we could take that seriously if we wanted to.
Yeah.
But no, it's not promoting it. Definitely not.
No. You are not saying spiritual growth is the truth.
In our book.
No, no. On the contrary, there's always some kind of a... Richard also says that he himself is a skeptic.
Skeptical. If you want to sum the point of view,
yeah.
I mean, that book covers a huge chunk of my life, at least 30 years, really, actually more. And if, you know, if I was going to sum it up in a phrase, what my point of view, I would say, I hope I'm open-minded skeptic. I'm definitely skeptical, and I hope I'm open-minded. Yeah.
And what was the first impulse that made you look for something deeper? Can you remember?
Very, very easily, unhappiness, as it is for many people who set out on a seeker's path, whatever that means. Yeah, unhappiness with life.
And
satisfaction.
Was that in your teenage years or later? When did that really become clear?
It didn't become... it didn't turn into something which could be described as a spiritual search until my late 20s. So before that, I sort of coped with my dissatisfaction with life and my unhappiness in more, you know, the more usual ways, you know, drinking beer, taking drugs, hanging out with friends, that sort of thing. So, but in my late 20s, I suppose, I had a major acid trip, which kind of blew apart my conceptions of what reality was. And that was probably, you know, it's difficult to assign cause and effect, but that was probably the first step. And then I dabbled with some meditation techniques on my own after that, didn't get anywhere, and went off to do TM. And the TM initiation was almost as big a revelation as the acid trip had been. So that was it. After that, I was just hooked. I was gone. Forget about the next 30 years, really.
I was surprised when you described the TM experience. I also was initiated, also with this mantra, nothing happened for me. So that, can you describe that a little bit more? What really happened there? Is that in some way comparable to the not being there?
No, I would say not. Maybe some people would disagree. I would just say anyone who has experienced transcendence at all, it was just a profound and very deep transcendence. But then add to that the fact that this is the first experience of this. I was probably, can't remember how old I was by then, maybe 30, roughly, and this is the first experience of transcendence ever in my life. And that transcendence, it just, the chatter in the mind just switched off for quite a while, and it was the first time in my life since I've been old enough to be conscious that the chatter in my mind had switched off while I was awake. So it was quite an experience, and I can remember it was even sort of slightly trippy, because I can remember leaving the centre on a Sunday afternoon, having been initiated, and it's like the buses, the red London buses going, I was like, wow, you know, the red of them is like, you know, as if I'd taken acid. So it was quite profound. And I mean, I'm no expert on this at all, but I believe this is relatively common with first experiences of TM, maybe other meditation techniques as well. But I don't think it's that uncommon. Some people, it's like it does nothing for them. Other people can have this really profound experience straight away, which of course is then, it's a huge hook. It's like, wow, I want more of this. So I kept going, I became very passionate.
Yeah, and would you say it has something to do with this mantra?
I'd have to say that in the kind of normal world of cause and effect, because there I go in innocently to the centre. I've given them a huge sum of money, and I think a bag of fruit and a bunch of flowers. I'm feeling very sceptical. They give me this mantra, they whisper it in my ear. I start repeating it, thinking, God, this is going to be boring, and then ba 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 ba, you know, straight down into this totally new state of. Down or up, I'm not sure which, but or out, anyway, into this totally new state of transcendence, yeah.
So it's not just that the mind stops or is quieter, there's something really totally different. There's a, yeah,
for me, it's totally different, and, you know, and that's, I would say that's what kind of, that was this huge hook, which then kept me going for the next 30 years, yeah.
And also interesting is, that is maybe just historically interesting, that from there you went to this Indian Guru Raj.
Your memory.
And obviously a lot of the TM people, especially those in the higher ranks, went also there.
Yeah.
And can you explain
what
happened? What is the connection there?
Yes, this Guru Rajananda Yogi, who I followed passionately for about 3 years, he came out of nowhere and his organization grew enormously very quickly. And what happened was that he had somehow attracted to him a woman who was very high up in the TM movement, and then through her, a man who was also very high up in the TM movement, so they became his followers. But this was at exactly the same time that Maharishi, who'd always decried cities, he'd always said, don't bother with cities, they're a waste of time, he started running city courses. And so, of course, we were very pure and very holy, and we thought, well, we don't want to learn cities. So a lot of people left TM at that time, including a lot of the teachers. They became, you know, very dissatisfied. So this organization, Guru Raj's, went from nothing to really quite large very quickly in several different countries. So suddenly, out of nowhere, he had an organization in America, Australia, Britain, several other European countries as well.
Yeah. So the guy must have had something to
yes.
Some kind of energy or...
Oh, lovely, limpid, eyes, dark eyes, into which one could melt as if into pools of light. Oh, yes, extremely powerful meditation techniques, and a kind of wider appeal than TM, because he had, he taught us, we learned three different individual meditation techniques. And then, of course, we had retreats and groups and so forth, and he had this weird chant that we did, which is completely unlike any chant I've ever come across anywhere else, which might just be my ignorance, I don't know. And we do this chant for maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, and then we meditate while somebody struck this enormous Tibetan gong, and it just took us to places that, you know, other beers could not reach. So I mean, TM was powerful, but Raj's techniques were like supercharged. That was lovely. For about 3 years. Do you want to know what happened?
Afterward,
when it all, as these things do sometimes, very rarely, of course, it just fell apart in this huge explosion of scandal.
Because of sex?
Well, sex was the reason it became public. It turned out that he had taken as lovers three different women high up in his organisation. I'm not going to tell you the whole story, because it's a wonderful story, and obviously I wanted to buy the book, but he'd basically taken three women as lovers, all high up in his organisation. None of them knew about the other two. A little bit dodgy. Of course, obviously, eventually somebody gossiped or boasted or something like that, and they each found out that they were not unique. And so there was a huge explosion of rage, but it then turned out, of course, that he'd also been up to all sorts of other things, as gurus quite often get up to. But the hierarchy had been keeping it all secret, you know, for the higher good, for the good of, you know, our spiritual growth and so forth. But when the sex scandal hit the headlines and these three women sort of went into a state of justified rage, maybe, then all the other scandal came out as well. And by then I was a teacher for him. I'd been teaching meditation for him for about 2 or 3 years. And all the teachers were summoned to a big meeting in London, and we sat there in shocked horror as all of these revelations were revealed to us, you know, about alcohol, money, sex, almost everything you could imagine.
And how did you feel? I mean, it was not like...
How did I feel? Yeah. Horrified. It was terrible. It was awful. You have to think back to the time. This was in the late 70s. So you have to understand that this was not just a guru, this was the avatar of the new age that we had here, you see. And I mean, obviously there were other groups who also had different, the one and only avatar of the new age, but we knew that we had the real one, all the others were fake. And we're sitting there and all of this scandal is being revealed to us. It's just awful. It's just terrible. Really, it was very, very traumatic. Yeah, and a huge learning experience.
Yeah. So never again after that?
Not with a guru. No, I tried. I had hung around loosely. I mean, you could say, I mean, I hadn't exactly been unfaithful to Guru Raj, but I had hung around slightly with Muktananda, Baba Muktananda, who was the guru of the Siddha Yoga movement. So I tried, I thought, I'll try now to see if I can fall in love with Muktananda in the way that I fell in love with Guru Raj, but no, nothing. I mean, I went to three Siddha Yoga ashrams, actually. Just didn't feel anything. So that was it for gurus. It's over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Although you had also something to do with the Buddhism in different ways.
Oh, God, yes.
There was this Tibetan Lama, Sogyal Rinpoche, that you met.
Yeah, very early on when nobody knew about him.
Yeah. He was a kind of a little bit enjoying too much beer and women and
Well, I think it might have been martinis rather than beer. I'm not sure. And we didn't know about the women at that point. This was very early on when he was very young. He'd only just arrived here. And I did this course with him on Buddhist meditation with about 12 other people. And of course, later on, he became hugely famous. He wrote that book, The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. Set up a huge ashram, I think in France, set up this organization, RIFA, which became very large. And then, of course, all the scandal began to come out about him as well.
He was also in this famous film, Little Buddha, or Living Buddha, or Little Buddha, by Bertolucci.
Was that anything to do with him?
Yeah, he was one of the characters.
Oh, right, okay.
He was the one who chose the little children there.
Oh, right, okay.
So he was already very famous.
Yeah, hugely famous. And of course, now, like so many others, sort of brought down my scandal. So there were several. I kind of flirted with Buddhism. I mean, I was still a very serious seeker. So I kept flirting. I thought, right, I'll become a Buddhist, that's easy. It's not easy. I don't know if any of you have tried to become a Buddhist. But, well, it wasn't easy for me. I mean, I tried quite hard. I was quite sincere. It would not take. I could not become a Buddhist. And I had a friend who was a Buddhist teacher who offered to take me to, this was RIGPA, Sonyo Rinpoche's organization. She actually offered to drive me to Oxford so I could take refuge in the Sangha. And something in me just couldn't do it. I just couldn't become a Buddhist. I tried with about 5 different Buddhist groups. It just got worse and worse. Each Buddhist group I went to, it just got worse.
But if you look at the teaching, that the essential teaching, it seems to me that if there's anything similar to what you would say in non-dualistic,
absolutely,
God, there is, in Buddhism, it is said that there is no I.
Absolutely.
So in that way, there is a connection.
Yeah, definitely. And the central teaching is great. I've got absolutely no problems with the central teaching. In fact, I have no problems with Buddhism whatsoever, except it turns out I can't be a Buddhist. I mean, I can't tell you why. I just can't. It's a bit like, I don't know, it's a bit like going to the latest film all your friends love and you don't like it. You can't help it. It's just, you know, your friends get very disappointed.
I want to read a little quote, okay? And want you to ask you what you can say about this. I find that quite. You said, you write here, up to this point, I have lived by Socrates' dictum, the unexamined life is not worth living.
Yeah.
Now I'm beginning to wonder whether the too much examined life may not be worth living either.
Yeah, and I stand by that. Yeah, I started wondering that probably about 30 years ago, and I still stand by it, yeah. Yeah, I think there is a kind of balance, you know. I think, I'm not sure whether Socrates is right that the unexamined life is not worth living, because I have not tried to live it. So the unexamined life might turn out to be wonderful, you know, if I'd spent my life, I don't know, drinking beer and going to football matches, that might have been great. So I'm not going to comment on that. But I do think, you know, yeah, there is a point, it's a bit like there comes a point maybe in therapy. You know, therapy can be great up to a point, and then maybe there can be too much therapy. And I think the same with seeking, you know, it can be great up to a point, you get a lot from it, a lot of entertainment apart from anything else, and then perhaps it can just become neurotic, maybe, for some people.
Well, you certainly did the other side here quite a lot, huh? This examining of.
I did examine. Yes, I cannot, whatever I can be accused of, I cannot be accused of living the unexamined life. I did examine my life a lot, and some people would say too much. Yeah.
That can sometimes be the end of the seeking, if you really can't go on anymore. Or
yeah.
Well, and it was not.
No, I can't go.
You also have some philosophical parts in the book here, some serious questions.
Absolutely. I like to think that it's both very humorous and an extremely serious book. Yeah.
That's it. There's one which I find very interesting is the headline already, Matter Thinks. Does matter think?
How does matter think?
Yeah. What is consciousness? Yeah. That is certainly one of the main questions in not only philosophy, it's also scientists. The brain, is the brain producing consciousness, or what is consciousness? Can you say something about that?
Well, firstly, I would say there are several chapters in there which could be considered to be philosophical, but the two key philosophical questions that it addresses is really the nature of consciousness. Can consciousness be explained by physical reality? And the other is free will.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that I've included those is because it seems to me that both of those questions bear quite centrally on a lot of the other material in the book, on, you know, the material that I'm seeking. So I felt like they were worth considering. And now, what was your question?
If you can say something about the problem that is involved, or is part of this question, what is consciousness?
The problem, which a lot of physicists, psychologists and so forth acknowledge, and a lot of others don't. So there's a huge controversy over this, and it's quite clear in the book that I'm very much on one side of this controversy and not the other. But the problem, which is actually called the hard problem by a lot of physicists, so does even physicists think this is a very difficult problem, and a lot of physicists think it is a problem that will never be solved, and I agree with those, is that we have this material stuff. Okay, we understand this material stuff wonderfully now. I mean, we even understand it down to the atomic level, the subatomic level, and so forth, but it's still kind of material stuff. How does it produce consciousness? I mean, put it another way, we know that there is in the skull this thing, this object, called the brain, and that brain obviously is intimately connected with thinking. How does that happen? I mean, if you take a brain out of a skull and lay it on a lab and look at it, or even if you keep it somehow hooked up so it's still alive, there is absolutely nothing about its physical structure that suggests that it would somehow be able to create consciousness. So the basic idea is really that this is an imponderable question, that it can, you know, whatever else can be explained, this will always remain. This is my contention and the contention of some other physicists, neuroscientists, psychologists, but not all, that no matter what exploration we do, the nature of consciousness and its connection to physical matter cannot be explained.
Is it consciousness the same as subjectivity or the subject as such?
In a way, I don't want to go there too much, because the trouble is, once we start asking what consciousness is, this could eat up the rest of the evening and it would be quite boring as well. So I prefer to keep it simple and say that what I mean by consciousness, and what I believe a lot of physicists, neuroscientists, psychologists believe by, mean also by consciousness, is simply experience. You know, so we don't need to argue about it philosophically. We can just say that it lies in the realm of what I often call the bleeding obvious, that there is experience. There's nothing about physical matter that we know of that explains why there should be experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, to put it in a nutshell. And I know there's a lot of physicists and psychologists and philosophers out there who disagree with this. So it's like there's a little philosophical war going on at the moment between these two sides, and I'm very much on one side of that. I mean, if you want to investigate the other side, the obvious philosopher to go to is Daniel Dennett, who very much says there is no problem. What are you talking about? It's all been explained.
I just have to think that what Tony often says recently, there is no consciousness.
Yeah, sure.
That is also what kind of hit me.
Yeah,
because my whole career was about what is consciousness, the question as a challenge philosophically.
Yeah.
And then Tony comes along and says, well, it's bullshit.
Absolutely,
there is no consciousness.
I use the word consciousness because I don't think it's possible to have this discussion about philosophy, neuroscience, psychology, without using a word like that. But, of course, actually, all we're talking about is the fact that there is experience. You know, we don't have to add on to that, the idea of consciousness, but I'm just trying to deal with the subject in the way that it's normally sort of discussed and referred to by the philosophers and the neuroscientists. Yeah.
So maybe soon I will say, please read something
right
that you would like to read.
Okay.
And then maybe everyone can ask questions to this about the book or
about anything.
And then we have a little break,
yeah,
like maybe 10 minutes. And then if that is okay with you, we just have an open evening, like as a non-duality.
Bearing in mind that usually we talk about non-duality.
Is that okay for you too? Or would you like me to ask more questions about the book?
Should we go for it then? No one's saying anything else, so should we go for it?
Yeah.
If you've got the book, we'll see. I've got two passages. I'm not sure why they come to me, because the book covers such a huge ground, it's difficult to get a feeling for it just from one or two extracts. But a couple of extracts have come to me. And I'll try one of them, and then if you've got the patience for the other one, it's not going to be the one you want. I'm sorry.
No, that's totally fine. I mean, just want to mention that.
Yeah,
there's also past life experiences in the book, and all of what you can think. It's everything is there in the book.
Christian homed in on the fact that there is an account in this book of I'm going to do the air quotations when I say past life experience, right? There's no suggestion of either belief or disbelief in this. As I said, I'm an open-minded skeptic, but nevertheless, the experience was a past life therapy. And there's a description in there where, in a past life, it turned out that I was a pilot in the Luftwaffe during the war. So, Christian tried to persuade me to read that out. Unfortunately, that's firm on my list, so we're not going to get to it.
But I hope you are not sad when I leave this and go over there.
I'll overcome it.
I
will be sad. Thank you very much. Okay, well, thank you for the questions. That was fun, yeah. So, I had a kind of, for many years, I have had a kind of subsidiary life in Wales, with friends in Wales, which is an area of Britain, whether you know this or not, which is very much a centre of hippies and all sorts of things that we get up to, and lots of very weird beliefs, strange beliefs. So this is one, it's probably the longest paragraph in the book. I may try to cut it down. It's just the description. I just set the scene. I'm standing in the kitchen in Wales in a friend's flat, and I've been having an argument with another friend's 18-year-old daughter. Right, and this girl looks absolutely terrifying. You know, she's got tattoos and dreadlocks, and she's got bits of metal sticking out of her face all over. And we just had an argument about whether people in London or Wales are the maddest, because I'm claiming that the people I know in Wales are quite a lot madder than the people in London, and she really doesn't like this. So I just said, you know, we end up agreeing to disagree, and she makes me a cup of tea. So it's all right in the end, you know. We don't come to blows, but this is then my justification for why I think the people in Wales are that much madder. I don't know if I'll get to the end of this very long paragraph, but I'll give it a go. Oh, by the way, if I do, there's a reference in here to something called home education. I don't know if you have this here in Germany. Parents have the right in Britain to keep their children out of school, not send them to school, and educate them at home. Yes, can you do that here?
No.
No.
Oh, it'd probably be put in.
No, well, we can do it in Britain, and it's called home education when a parent does that, so that's a reference if we ever get there. So she's just made this cup of tea. The kitchen in which we are standing belongs to a friend who seriously believes that the world is ruled by David Icke's shape-shifting, 12-foot-high, bejeweled lizards. Perhaps you do too, but if that is the case, you really should not be reading this book. His ex-partner drives from her home to a nearby village every few days to collect water from a spring in a huge plastic container, having been convinced that drinking tap water will imperil her health and may shorten her life. Unsurprisingly, the woman who has convinced her of this has also sold her an expensive water filtration system. Presumably, this is so that she does not become seriously ill or die from the bugs which might have contaminated the spring water, for the fact is that sheep piss nearby. Yet most of us drink tap water, and our longevity continues to climb remorselessly upwards. Her next-door neighbour channels angelic healing forces, and a friend across the road is the mouthpiece for a spirit guide who dispenses cosmic wisdom every Thursday evening. Just up the street lives a lady who regularly goes on a detox diet of such savagery that it deserves to be classified as an eating disorder. If you greet her with a hug, you find yourself holding bones. The man a few houses along from her meditates for up to 8 hours a day. If he meets you in the village, he may grunt and nod. Parents going for home education, which, as one of my friends caustically asserts, down here should really be called no education. The parents keep their children away from school and instead gather with them regularly at coastal coffee bars. There they ignore the children, who are left for hours on end to reenact Lord of the Flies on the beach. One of these parents is receiving help from an entire healthcare team, including psychotherapists and social workers. She seems to have made it her mission in life to seduce each of these in turn. In this, she has so far been remarkably successful. That's just a little taste of my hippie friends in Wales. To be fair to the woman I referred to at the end there, at the time that I knew her, she'd only managed to seduce two of her care workers. So, but she was hoping to work her way through the others, I believe. Have you got the patience for one more?
Yeah.
Yeah? Is anybody easily upset by attacks on religions here? Well, we'll go for it anyway. This is the very last section in the book, and one of the reasons it's the last is because it's one of my favourites, right? So this is a real incident, truly happened to me and a couple of friends. It's a very minor incident, but I think it's just very indicative of something. Probably happened about 2 years ago now. I do Tai Chi, by the way, I should say. So me and my two friends, we just come from a Tai Chi class. We always go for a coffee afterwards at this particular cafe. It's called Trendy Vicar. I am sitting in a cafe with two friends after a Tai Chi class. It is a very good cafe, so we come here regularly. As usual, it is full of young mothers with toddlers, lycra-clad cyclists, and a few businessmen working on their laptops or holding discreet meetings. Mashed avocado, sourdough bread, and healthy smoothies feature prominently on the menu. Today, sitting opposite us is a vicar. He is a trendy, modern vicar. He has a shaved head, and he is planning his church business with an associate on his iPad. He is the very same vicar who was banned our Tai Chi group from using his church hall.
I do not want to engage him in conversation. I prefer to enjoy my latte. But as he gets up to leave, my friend Simon asks him, why won't you let us use your hall for our Tai Chi classes? The vicar patiently explains. Many people, he says, believe that Tai Chi is simply an innocent form of exercise. But it's not. It's a Taoist practice. Taoism is a non-Christian religion which is trying to make converts in this country. As a Christian, I believe that if I let you use God's premises for your Tai Chi classes, he'll be angry with me. Then, when I die, I'll have to explain myself to him. To show that there are no hard feelings, he shakes hands with each of us as he leaves. At this point, I cannot help being drawn in. I grip his hand tightly so that he cannot easily withdraw it, look into his eyes, and I say, the problem you have is that you really don't really know what kind of a God you're going to meet when you die. God might turn out to be a Taoist. Then he might be angry with you because you didn't let our Tai Chi group use your church hall. He does not say anything to this. He looks momentarily confused. Then I let his hand go. I want to add, do you realize how psychotic you sound to ordinary people like us? I want to add it, but I do not. There's a few other... One of the things that strikes me, and one of the reasons I like that passage, and there are a few other passages in there. I mean, there is a lot about religion in the book, actually. And it's something to do with our conditioning, but because we're kind of so conditioned, quite often in social situations like that, but also on radio interviews and on television and so forth, I hear people saying what, in a way, are the most outrageous things. But nobody notices because we're so conditioned. You know, that you know, we just kind of accept it. It's like we've gone deaf to kind of how bizarre and how mad some of the things that are said in the name of religion are. And actually, as I'm saying that, have you got a page for one very short other? So because this is just another example of this, and it's from the same chapter. It's extremely short. It's just another example. I'm just listening to the radio very innocently one day, and I hear somebody say the most outrageous thing, and nobody, it's on a panel, and nobody says anything, nobody questions it, nobody objects, because it's just one of the kind of things we're so used to hearing. So this is called The Resurrection of the Flesh. It's about the fact that, you know, God is going to resurrect us at the end of the days from our graves, which is a moment I hope you're all looking forward to as much as I am. But when you hear the justification for it, this dogma in this passage, you might change your minds about this. So this is called The Resurrection of the Flesh. During a discussion of faith on BBC Radio, a representative of one of the Abrahamic religions patiently explains why we must be physically resurrected from our graves. It is so that God can judge us, and if we are not worthy of salvation, cast us into hell to be tortured for all eternity. It is necessary for us to have a physical body, as otherwise we could not experience this torment. Not one of the other panelists, who all sound like quite reasonable 21st century men and women, thinks it worth commenting on this poisonous belief, nor on the nature of such a monstrously evil deity. No one states that this opinion sounds psychopathic or possibly psychotic. Everyone lets it pass, I suppose, in a spirit of interfaith tolerance, as if the religious scholar had said nothing more remarkable than the weather's looking good for tomorrow. There you go. End of extracts. I do find that one of the astonishing things about the conditioned world where religions are concerned, you know, it is like we go deaf to these outrageous statements. I mean, there's another little section in the books I won't read to you about, you know, there was a big hurricane, a huge hurricane in Florida, and of course, within minutes, churchmen are saying, this is God's wrath visited on America because we tolerate homosexuality. And it's like, what? I mean, this is kind of, I mean, this is virtue, this is psychotic. I don't think psychotic is an unkind word to say. It's like, well, I can see why hurricanes might be God's wrath visited on humanity because of global warming. You know, that kind of makes sense. But anyway, you know, I'll leave the point there. I think I've made the point, hopefully. So, okay, what are we going to do next? Are we going to take a break?
Well, or maybe some people want to ask something about the topics that we
have. Okay.
Like, for example, I would add that this Christian religion is really absolutely mad. And the content, what is the idea behind it? And yeah, we are so used over almost 2,000 years to believe in this or to think this is okay, that's the religion. But how there can be one Son of God and the rest is what? I mean, that's one thing. Then the whole thing with the resurrection.
It makes no sense on any level. It's astonishing. And one of the astonishing things I sort of find is because, you know, the New Testament is, you know, supposed to be so much kinder than the Old Testament because the New Testament brings in love. But actually, the story in the New Testament is like 10 or 20 times crazier than the story in the Old. I mean, the Old Testament is kind of makes sense. You've got this tribal God who is very, very bad-tempered and angry, and that's how he behaves. So, yeah, everybody can relate to that. Everybody who's known anyone with an angry father can relate to that. But the New Testament story, I mean, it is just bizarre beyond belief. It doesn't make sense on any level. You know, this is God who is all-knowing and all-powerful and all-loving, but will then torture us for all eternity if we fail this one very, very bizarre test that he sets for us. You know, we need salvation to save us from sins, which he knew we were going to commit because he's omniscient, and which presumably he deliberately created us to commit because he's also omnipotent. I mean, I'm not going to go on. It's just kind of bad. And yet, for 2,000 years, it holds more or less complete sway over the Western world. What? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
So, I mean, what we, as seekers, when we follow the guru, for example, for me it was Osho, the church would point it out and say, look at these stupid idiots.
Yeah.
They have a guru and adore the guru. And yeah, what is Jesus? I mean, it's even more weird. The guy is not even there.
Yeah.
And it is considered to be the only one. So all these things. And it's the powerful positions that these people still have and hold in society. And this is crazy.
One of the things I find both, you know, very amusing but also absolutely horrifying is when you hear, for example, Catholic priests, bishops and cardinals denouncing cults, denouncing guru cults. It might be, what do you think the Catholic Church is? One of the most successful cults the world has ever seen. Also one of the most, you know, successful totalitarian organizations that the world has ever seen.
Yeah.
You know.
So we should
And I'm not even going to go near the topic of, you know, abuse and so, but it's just too big. I mean, and what can you do other than weep? That's it. Yeah.
I was going to ask you, what was your impetus to, or the drive to write this book?
Yeah.
What was behind that?
Well, I have no intention of doing it whatsoever. You know, I've written four books on Long Duality. I didn't want to go anywhere near what I'm. It isn't an autobiography, but there's a lot of autobiographical material in it. And then, getting on over four, under 5 years ago, I got into a new relationship. And I think, as often happens, you know, we started telling stories of our past, and at one point, you know, Dawn, who's very valiantly sitting there behind the camera filming this at the moment, said to me, "You should write this down, you know, this is interesting." No. Yeah, well, yeah, go on. So I just tried a little bit, just took one anecdote and sat in a coffee bar, which I love doing anyway, and just wrote it down, and then, you know, next time I saw Dawn, I read it to her. I said, "Yeah, that's good, you know, go on with that." So I just did, and that, you know, eventually there was a book. That's all I can say, you know, and I would say, in a way, it did write itself. You know, it was a sort of very easy, I mean, I'm extremely lazy, you know, I've got to that age where I don't have to work. So I'm certainly not going to do anything that I don't have to do. It's very taxing. It's just very easy to do. Yeah. Anything else on this before?
I just want to make a remark. I have read this book two times and I enjoyed it very much.
There you go. I'm going to hold it up to the camera on that one. Okay, there's a little advertisement available on Amazon. And also, if you want an autograph copy, available in the hall back there as well. Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah.
I was just wondering, do you have any spiritual experiences now, recently?
Yeah, I'm always a bit cautious with that phrase, spiritual experience, possibly for fairly obvious reasons, and maybe like a lot of people who've been trained psychologically and psychotherapeutically, I prefer, you might think I'm nitpicking, but I prefer the word transpersonal, and the reason that you tend to read about transpersonal psychology rather than spiritual psychology, because it sounds more respectable. They actually mean exactly the same thing, transpersonal and spiritual, but anyway. So having cleared that up, I would say, I mean, I obviously have quite a lot of transpersonal experiences that have gone into the book, and more recently I've had still ongoing sort of what would normally be considered Kundalini experiences and so forth. Yeah, to which I would be reluctant to assign any significance whatsoever. Yeah, I would just say, okay, yeah, these are experiences. This may be why I resist the word spiritual. I think as soon as we use the word spiritual, it's like there's such a weight. That word is carrying such a weight that it's something incredibly special. And I think, so I resist that word. You know, I would say transpersonal experiences are just experiences on a certain kind of level. Just like, you know, there are physical experiences, emotional experiences, psychological experiences, transpersonal experiences. So I wouldn't necessarily assign any great significance to that. But yeah, just to some extent that's ongoing, yeah.
You said, or you read something like, it seems that gurus fear psychotherapists.
Yeah, not quite that. Yeah, I don't think it's that they fear them, it's just they don't want their disciples, their devotees to go to them. I don't think that's any more mysterious than saying, you know, an electrician fears other electricians. They don't want their clients to go to other religions. It's just, you know, it's competition. I think there's a bit more, but I'm being a bit simplistic. There's a bit more with the guru psychotherapist thing. I think, you know, that we start going to psychotherapists, it's quite possible that all sorts of pennies might start dropping, as we say. Do you have that phrase also in German? Pennies dropping. It's like suddenly you get a breakthrough in your ideas and your thinking. And I think maybe that's it, you know. I mean, that famous thing, isn't it? Osho, you know, leave your shoes in your mind at the door. Yeah, now I can see very good reasons for leaving your mind at the door. I'm not cynical necessarily about that instruction, but nevertheless, we could be cynical or skeptical about it. But the guru, in a way, does gain an advantage if we don't think too clearly, particularly about the unending queue of attractive young women who are going through his sleeping quarters. And I think, you know, one of the problems of people going to psychotherapists is that, you know, we can wake up to seeing the world in all sorts of new ways. And that can be a threat to everything that we've been doing up to then. So if we've been a devotee of the guru up to that point, going to a psychotherapist could be a threat to that, in the same way that it might be a threat to our marital relationships. Does that kind of make sense? So I think it's a little bit more than just not wanting a rival. Yeah. And of course, lots of people go to both gurus and psychotherapists, and there's no problem at all. That can also happen. Yeah.
And psychotherapists could have become a guru.
Yeah, sometimes do. It's like, can a psychotherapist or a guru or both? Same for, I mean, Jung, Freud, Andy Lang, they all have kind of something of the guru about them.
So, Richard, where does sort of the book, the stories, sort of fit in with the talks you give and the content and whatever's coming through? Is the book and the stories in there and the experiences or whatever just part of what is?
Mm.
That's how you would say Absolutely. That? Whether you play with music and you would sit there and play a violin for us, you read from your book and tell us these stories and
It's just what's happening for that idea. I mean, I've deliberately not gone there not really at all. I mean, I do mention the fact that I give talks on non-duality there, partly, you know, there is a bit of a section about all the audience members I most remember for having attacked me over the years. So I put that in, but really I kind of kept it out, partly because, I mean, I've written 4 books about non-duality. If anybody wants to know about those, please buy them and read them, of course. But partly because this is deliberately some of it is philosophical and you can tie it up. The stuff about free will, you can tie up beautifully with non-duality, of course. But most of this is quite, the normal way of looking at it would be, well, most of this is clearly biographical. Mm-hmm. So my way of looking at it would be, well, it's story.
Yeah.
It's a collection of stories which apparently happen to an apparent person in an apparent past.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you also reflect on memory from the beginning already. You say, well, I don't know what really memory means here. We are more creating this, what we call memory. It's almost like a creation at the moment.
I have to say, when I wrote, I think that's a very important point, but when I wrote it, I wasn't in any way particularly thinking about that from what could be called a non-dual perspective. I was just making a what I think is a perfectly obvious point from the psychological point of view as to how memory works. And probably the easiest way to sum up how memory works for the layman is it doesn't work very well. Basically. So it's worth making that point because this claims to be a book of memories and it has to be understood that those memories. My memory is as faulty as anybody else's. If anybody, nobody is supposed to recognize themselves in this book. But if they do and they object to what I've written, I'm hoping that this is my get out of jail free card, that memory is very faulty. However, I have to confess this has already happened once. I have had an extremely angry Buddhist on my case who should never have, I don't even know how, I'm going to use the plural pronoun to conceal their gender. I don't know how they knew about it. There's no, you know, they shouldn't have known about it. I mean, I'm talking about somebody I knew many, many years ago. I don't know whether they've been secretly following my career, but they did find out about it, specifically the bit about themselves, and they are very, very angry with me about it. Yeah, and there's a few other characters in that book I hope never find out about it. But what can you, I mean, this is the danger if you start writing about reality. This is the danger. What do you do, you know, when push comes to shove? You either kind of wimp out and you leave it out, or you put it in there and risk offending someone. But, you know, I think this is a case of art trumps life. I'm certainly not the first writer to have lost a friend or an acquaintance who's recognised themselves in a work of literature. Sorry, not that I'm claiming this is a work of literature, that would be a bit pompous of me.
Break and then start fresh again.
Okay,
and let's do that. At this time, maybe you can sign books.
Yeah, absolutely. But only my own books. I'm not signing random books written by other people. Yeah, sure.
Here, sign this book.
Yeah. I've got first edition of D.H. Lawrence here. Then you sign it for me. I'm not doing that. Yeah, let's take a break.
To me, it sounds funny to sign books in a one-way world.
I know. Well, it sounds funny to write them.
How
can they
want to keep them?
There's coffee and biscuits.